Thank you and welcome. And a reminder to our speakers and also those who ask questions, we have some folks joining us by speakerphone, and we want to make sure that they're able to participate in the conversation as well. It's a pleasure to be here. As just said, I'm Mike Green. I'm the Vice President of the Truman Project, but I also help lead a nationwide coalition called Operation Free. It's a bipartisan group of veterans, most of whom served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who see a very, very clear connection between energy use and national security. And that connection extends from the tactical level up to the strategic and the grand strategic level. And we're going to hear from four very distinguished gentlemen from all four military services who've seen that everywhere from what the military calls the tactical edge, the leading edge of combat. They've seen that in the cockpits of our most advanced fighter aircraft. They've seen it as the commanders of aircraft carriers and fighter wings. They've seen it on the ground in the Expeditionary Marine Corps. My own experience with this is mostly on the tactical edge. My first job out of college, I was a second lieutenant in the Army and served in Iraq for over a year with an infantry company that was entirely dependent for all of its operations on a fuel supply that traversed an incredibly dangerous route. We've all heard this 1 in 25 number, but believe me, it's reality. 1 in 25 of those convoys ends in a casualty. We defended those convoys all year. We called it fighting for our suburb. And that wasn't just for transportation fuel for vehicles. It was also for the power grid of our forward operating base, the generators that we use, our communication systems, the radars that informed us that we were about to be hit by mortar fire. All of those systems ran off generators of gas and power. So there's a really strong impetus from everyone who's worn the uniform over the last, say, 20 years, I think, especially in these conflicts, and a really strong impetus you're seeing from the Pentagon that I think we can understand, to find a way to unshackle ourselves from a single source dependence on fuel, and to find a way to unshackle ourselves from the energy challenges that we face, that in some cases cost lives, in the air, on the ground, and the sea. So with that, I'm looking forward to an incredible panel and hopefully a great conversation. First, I'd like to introduce a friend and a bit of inspiration, Colonel Dan Nolan, seriously. Colonel Dan Nolan, of the United States Army, retired. Colonel Nolan not only was the artillery commander for 1st Armored Division, where I served, but also, and he will never tell you this himself, but Colonel Owen was a true pioneer in the Army. Colonel Owen was one of the first to look at the casualty figures and the incredible losses we were taking in the fuel supply chain, in the energy supply chain, on the ground in Iraq, and try to find a way to do better. And his innovations, his introduction of things like the fully burdened cost of fuel into our thinking, and his embrace of new technologies and new approaches in that fight have really inspired, I think, in many ways, led the Army. I was at a meeting at the White House yesterday, which was recognized by a senior Pentagon official as a true pioneer. So it's a real pleasure to have Colonel Owen with us, and we look forward to your remarks, sir.
Well, gosh, how do you like me so far? Mike, thank you very much, and those were very kind words, but more hyperbole than I'm used to. And I'm starting off today because I'm the junior member of this panel. But as Mike was saying, I came to the realization of the energy insecurity this country faces after I left the military. I retired in 2002 and was working at a place called the Army's Rapid Equipment Force. And what the REF does is they find technology solutions to commanders' immediate battlefield challenges. At the time, in 2006, they were looking at challenges of improvised explosive devices, counter-sniper things. And so we were looking at robots and these really cool technologies. When we got an operational need statement from the Anbar province in western Iraq, from a Marine two-star general, and it was asking for a hydroelectric power station. Well, I was a strategic planner for the REF at the time. I said, this is kind of a weird one. Would you take a look at this? And I said, gosh, when did the Marines become, you know, Birkenstock wearing tree huggers? Well, it wasn't because they were environmentally sensitive, although we in the military very much are. It was because the most dangerous thing to do in the Anbar province was drive 5 gallons of diesel out to a Syrian border site. And so I started taking a deeper look into this, and what we found is that a lot of the casualties were occurring as we were moving supplies, and 70% of what we were moving was fuel and water. So that really was my introduction into the energy security world. And as I started looking at this deeper, I went from the tactical to the operational to the strategic level. And I started seeing incredible vulnerabilities that the the United States face because of two things. We have only one source for our transportation networks, and that's fossil fuels. And we are tied to an incredibly fragile grid. Any of you that were here in the last couple of weeks might have some experience with that. I live in Florida, we know about that stuff. But on the petroleum side, we really haven't done much about it. What can we do? We only have one mechanism that has the energy density that allows us to do that, and that's petroleum-based fuels. But now there are other options becoming available. And those options have got to be explored, because when you only have one option, you have no options. And that's the source of tactical failure. So what the Department of Defense is doing now is recognizing the insecurity, the energy insecurity we face, and taking active steps to address that, because that's what DOD does. They're looking at on the infrastructure side with some incredible investments, not shifting any monies, but using the money they're buying electricity anyway to look at renewable energy. And on the biofuel side, they're doing a similar thing. They're making sure that they have the capability to use these fuels as they become available. And the policy, as stated by the Department of Defense, is to look at first experimentation with the fuels, certification with the fuels, field demonstration with the fuels, and then finally, purchase of the fuels. When those fuels are drop-in replacements and meet the normal commercial requirements. So to get to that point, someplace in the future, there's going to have to be some investment made. And this isn't just a Department of Defense investment. The Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy are all involved in a joint effort to be able to ensure that we no longer have this single point of failure. Because when you pull up to the pumps today, there's three handles there. One says Venezuela, one says Saudi Arabia, and one says, well, hopefully not here, but in many places it says Iran. I'd much rather see them say Louisiana, Missouri, you name it someplace else in the United States, because those are products produced by Americans that have the opportunity to create a whole new industry for this. Because not only am I former military, I'm currently in the energy industry. And we as the nation that in the first half of the last century, we electrified the world. In the second half, we computerized it. Why shouldn't we lead the world into a new energy era and be the ones to reap the benefits of it? Thank you.
Thanks, Ramon. Next, I'd like to introduce General Seip. General Seip is a highly experienced Air Force officer, former F-15, Strike Eagle pilot. He's commanded air wings, hundreds of aircraft in operations around the world. I was also amazed to discover recently that while I was grunting my way across Iraq down there on fuel convoy duty and other things, as a two-star general, General Seip was in the cockpit of an F-15E Strike Eagle providing top cover for us as we moved through insurgent controlled areas. You don't see a lot of two-star generals driving eagles to cover grunts like me. So that stayed with me. But sir, we'd love to hear from you about what it looks like from the aviator's perspective, what it looks like from the Air Force perspective, and why these fuels in particular are so important.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here today. I realize on a Thursday afternoon you have lots of choices. The fact that we're not giving you free food and drink, and the fact that you are here tells me that you are interested in energy. Oh, let's leave that for you. Let me give you just a quick Air's perspective. One of the tenets of air power, and I don't care whether you're in fixed-wing aviation, or rotary-wing aviation, or no matter what service you're in, but one of the tenets of air power is that flexibility is the key to air power. I would submit to you that when you talk about energy security, that flexibility is the key to energy security. And when I say flexibility, I mean choices. I mean choices in the way of alternative fuels, choices that allow us to maintain our combat capability, our combat edge, choices that allow us to put drop-ins, meet our specs, as well as be cross-competitive. I saw it as Mike said, at the tactical level, flying armed missions over convoys. I saw them in the way of letters that my commanders had to write to parents about their sons and daughters that had lost their life in those convoys. I saw it from the aspect of being a 12th Air Force commander, my last assignment, where I had 7 wings. And as you may or may not know, when the price of oil goes up by $10 a barrel, that's a $1.3 billion bill for DOD. The United States Air Force has about $800 million. And no one shows up from the government with a check that says, yeah, I'll cover that for you, Mark. That means tough decision by our commanders. That means foregoing improvements in infrastructure. That means postponing improvements in quality of life programs for our families, or quality of job programs for our airmen. It also means lost training opportunities. It means lost combat capability. So from an operational level, that's a big deal. $800 million for just $10 for the price increase in the barrel of oil. Also as a country, $1 billion a day that goes overseas to pay for oil. And it goes to some countries that don't have our best interest in mind. In fact, despise the way you and I live. And I would submit to you that that money ends up in the hands of our enemies in the way of weapons. So as Admiral Woolsey used to be in the CIA, as mentioned, but this is the first war since the Civil War, and we as Americans are arming both sides of the conflict. And just think about that. You know, the AK-47s that I was responding to in my cockpit in that troops in contact situation, I may have funded that at the price of the pump there. So this idea about alternative energy, alternative fuels, is very important to us in the military. But we do have a way of doing this. And just recently, the Department of Defense put out the guidelines. 3 steps. First, we basically do a recognition or identification of a potential fuel source out there, and we do a certification, take it through the rigors as far as whether we even think this thing has a potential. Second, we do testing. That's exactly what the Navy's doing right now in RIMPAC with the Great Marine Fleet there. They're testing to see whether the infrastructure they have in place works. Can the sailors handle it? Is there a noticeable difference in performance? So we do that testing part, and that's all part of that overall responsibility that each service has in the way of organized training and equip. Research, development, testing, and evaluation is part of that organized training and equip. And then the last step of that is basically pricing and putting it on the market there. So as OSD will tell you, we'll take all comers. If you can bring something that will drop into our current gas tanks, for lack of a better phrase there, if it's cost competitive and it meets our specs, then we're ready to talk to you. And so that's the idea about flexibility as a key to energy security. Choices, competitiveness, redundancy, not tied to a finite source that someday, certainly not in our lifetime, but someday is going to run out. So why not start now preparing for the future? We as Americans want to be writing the history books, not someone writing it for us. So we have that opportunity to do in fact that by embracing alternative energies, clean energy, green energy, whatever you want to call it, brings to the table. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And we'll follow up with Admiral Larry Bachman. There's been a lot of discussion, of course, this week and over the last few days of the Navy's evaluation of advanced biofuels in the RIMPAC exercise next week, both in the aviation and service worker context. And we thought who better to speak to that than Admiral Bachman, who I think the year after the class of 1970 at the Naval Academy of Marines. The next year qualified as a naval aviator, flew F-14 Tomcats, commanded squadrons of F-14 Tomcats and up through. Eventually commanded the nuclear powered aircraft carrier, was it the Saratoga?
America's favorite aircraft carrier, the Carl Benson.
The Carl Benson, excuse me. I just made a massive mistake, okay, for it. Let's start with no further ado or mistakes on my part. I turn it over to you.
Thanks. I might add, Carl Benson is America's favorite carrier. Not just for hosting basketball games, but we have other things we've done. I'm going to approach this from the aspect of readiness, which is really crucial today. We're engaged all over the world, as you know, with all of our militaries, especially the Navy, with our strike groups, aircraft carrier strike groups that are engaged as we speak. And I know the Enterprise and Abraham Lincoln are now on the point today doing their missions. what I do normally during my day is I'm an advisor to the Naval Aviation Enterprise, which is a collaborative capability developed by the Navy about 8 years ago, which provides the readiness requirements we need when we need them at the most efficient cost we can achieve. And it looks at all aspects. It looks at the supply chain, it looks at spare parts, it looks at our manpower, our training, everything that goes into producing a ready aircraft or a ready aircraft carrier is looked at very closely by all the stakeholders, not just a stovepipe way of looking at things, but an enterprise approach. One thing that we are seeing, though, is we have a limited operations and maintenance budget every year. We try to stay within that budget and achieve our readiness entitlements or our readiness standards in order to meet these global demands. And I know from personal experience out there on the point in the Arabian Gulf, on the carrier, it takes about a million gallons a week to operate those air wings out there. Because every Sunday I used to refuel about a million gallons I'd put back in my tanks. And I the carrier carries about 3 million gallons of fuel. It takes a lot to operate on the point out there, and it's real important for us to maintain the readiness to do that. What we've been seeing recently in years as the oil volatility happens, as prices go up, then we have to make choices. As the general said, we have to choose between infrastructure and what are we going to do to make up that difference in price. I've seen whole squadrons shut down for months. Because we didn't have the fuel for them to train. We're seeing squadrons training only certain missions because we can't be ready in all training areas. We're making choices here, which is impacting readiness. When we deploy our units, we're trying to make them as ready as possible, but that's at the expense of those that are here that maybe just return. We need to do something to stabilize that environment. We can't be going halfway through the year and then find out that oil price just jumped and now we have to redo our whole training program. The consequences are just too dire to be doing that. We need options. As a former fighter aviator, when you go into a fight, you need options. You need a lot of them. And fuel, if we stuck with simple fossil fuel as the only solution forever, we're running out of options here as prices go up and down. So anything that can be done to stabilize that so that we can go and plan when reduced budgets in fiscal 13 and 14 as we can anticipate lower operations and maintenance budgets, but no decrease in requirements and in deployable forces, then we're going to have to do things better, smarter, faster, and cheaper. And that's what this is all about, doing things better, faster, cheaper. If we can find an alternative that will give us that, then that's well worth the small amount that we're trying to pay in R&D funds up front. What we're seeing next week will be demonstrated a strike group that will operate on a 50-50 mix of biofuel and petroleum JP or jet fuel products. Not to say that's the end-all solution to everything. It's one option. We've tested, and now we're doing a demonstration phase to look at the logistics part of it, to give the confidence in the sailors and the aviators that this is going to work and not degrade performance at all. And that's really key. We can't degrade the performance, especially in the aircraft arena. We need to continue to explore alternatives. There are other alternatives out there. One thing this country is famous for is innovation, addressing problems smartly and coming up with solutions and technologically, and we need to be able to do that. And what's really nice about this, going down the domestic biofuel route, is that each and every gallon of this comes with a stamp of Made in America, and that's kind of good. That can link the farmer in Kansas to national security. He now has a stake in the game. And I think that's an intangible of this. I think it's important. It builds up our energy infrastructure in this country. It creates jobs, and it builds up a whole new industry, which could be a global boon for us, and it could be a real boon for our economy. Because it's not only applicable to military applications. This is really important for the airline industry. This is really important for the shipping industry. And it's really important for the trucking industry and those things that make America move every day. And those are the potential growths of this. So what we're doing is taking military investments in R&D, seeing if they work, and looking at the applicability for the general public. And with that, you get private investment, you get a free market taken over, and we can create another new and very important industry in this country. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. And we at the Truman Project and Operation Free are very proud and very happy to be working with a number of allied organizations, including American Security Project. And our next speaker, General Cheney, is not only a former Marine commander of long experience in the Marine Corps, but is also the CEO of ASP, and so we're thrilled to have him and be working with them. The Marine Corps, in many ways, I think, exemplifies, General Cheney, I'll defer to you on all of this, of course, exemplifies the expeditionary portion of our military. The folks who've got to go out there and fight an environment and win an environment where literally every ounce that goes in a soldier Marine's backpack has to be thought out incredibly carefully. I come from the side of the Army that does that, the airborne force, you know, by airplanes, whatever we happen to have on us. And in an environment like that, energy comes down to questions like, how many batteries do I take on this mission so I can talk on my radio, and how many bullets is that in my brain? So in an environment like that, these questions become extremely, shall we say, they're your face questions. And so to give a perspective from me, what does it mean at that level of the tactical edge, I think, and to sum up for us?
You bet.
General Cheney.
Look out.
This is what happens when you don't think about logistics enough for an operation.
No, Mike, thanks for that introduction. I guess you planned it to have two Naval Academy grads on this side and a West Point guy over there, right?
Yeah, he's still working on his football
team. I was just going to say, Dan, how about that football team? I got to tell you.
This big wall between
the sailing stores. Yeah.
As Mike mentioned, I'm really here in two capacities. First, as the Chief Executive Officer of the American Security Project, and then secondly, as a Marine. So I'll talk about each one of those pieces. The American Security Project was founded in 2006, a spinoff from the campaign in 2004. Senators Hart, Hagel, Rudman, and Kerry got together, and there were several issues that when you mention them in the context of national security, often got downplayed because of the political implications. Energy security, climate change, nuclear security, terrorism, asymmetric operations, American competitiveness are just but a few that we cover at my organization. We are educational in nature. We're not a lobbying organization. And I say educational, biofuels is a prime example. Trying to educate you and the public about the advantages of biofuels and energy independence. When you put the national security slant on it, you're going to understand how our board is comprised. We've basically got a third Republicans, a third Democrats, and a third military. And the military component, Admiral Fox Fallon, four-star, Admiral Lester Lyles, four-star Air Force, General Chrisman, General Kennedy, myself, General Castelaw, would tend to take these issues and paint them from the national security side of it, hopefully nonpartisan. We have a very intense interest in energy independence and weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels. Now, I am a marine engineer by degree from the Naval Academy, but which, if you know what marine engineering is, it's ship design. So I went into the Marines wanting nothing to do with ships. I spent 30 years as a marine artillery officer, Dan, and you didn't use one of my lines. Artillery lends dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl. And you can picture the Marine lighting the fuse and standing back and watching the cannon explode. I say that in a bit of a joking manner, but the last two battalions I was in had over 300 pieces of rolling stock. This is one artillery battalion now, 300 pieces. Imagine the fuel requirement for that battalion, and Mike, you addressed that a little bit. When you're in the desert, your primary consideration is fuel, even above water and food and ammunition. You're not going anywhere without fuel. You are so dependent on fuel. And so whenever we did our contingency planning, we always sat down and topic number one, where are we getting the fuel? Where is it coming from? Where are we going to stockpile it? How can we protect it? and where's the origination of these fuels. Now, I'm pleased to have the Admiral sitting next to us. We love the Navy and the Marine Corps. You get us to the fight, and we sincerely appreciate that. I know your ships are primarily fueled with oil, although the one you were on, I'm sure it was a nuke, which gets
works
us,
well.
You know, we're supporters of energy independence, including nukes. But that said, we're almost the marine side of the house, totally dependent on fossil fuels. And we're also totally dependent on budget fluctuations of those fuels. When the price of oil goes up $10 a barrel, our budget increases the DoD budget $1.3 billion. $1.3 billion. Think about it. That's about the entire Marine Corps procurement budget for a year. I mean, it's astounding. And when you have those variances, and the Admiral talked about it, when the budget goes up and you got to pay it at the tactical level, you got to shut down. You can't afford to operate. I mean, it's just happens. Now, if you're in a combat situation, quite different, obviously, they're going to fund it. But nonetheless, it's a big problem. You've seen a lot in the press about the president and the control of cost of oil. And there was a nice little piece in The Economist last week. The president has no control over the price of oil today. I mean, he literally has no control over it. When Iran threatened to block the Straits of Hormuz back in early July, the next day, I think it was July 3rd, the price of oil spiked 4%. And those are fluctuations that we shouldn't have to live with. And what I think is equally incredible is Rand's study shows that roughly 12 to 15% of the DoD budget in some way is related to defense of the Persian Gulf. Think about that dependency. Think about the amount of money that we spend defending the Persian Gulf. And wouldn't it be nice to get off of that? The cost of biofuels has been a real hot topic. I'm sure the CNO addressed it earlier. A DOE study shows or says that maybe by 2017 or 2018, the cost of biofuels will be competitive with normal fossil fuels on a price per gallon basis. And I equate this to other acquisition programs. You got to pay up front to get the benefit and downrange. And that's what we're doing here. I mean, it's going to be amortized over the life of the program. The biofuel science is proven and it works. We just need to make the investment. Yesterday, I was with the president of the American Farmers Union, Roger Johnson. They are 100% behind biofuels, grown and made in America. And Dan, I got to thank you for giving me that line, because it leads me to a little bit of a closing story that I think you'll appreciate. When I was the commanding general at Parris Island, we had Toby Keith in to speak. I think most of you probably know him. This was right before he became famous with his big song, "How Do You Like Me Now?" We could barely afford him then. His two most favorite songs that he sings that I like are "I Love This Bar" and "Beer for Your Horses." But
mine too.
His best line is in the song "Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue," and it reads, "And you'll be sorry that you messed with the U.S. of A. because we'll put a boot up your ass. It's the American way." And that's what Marines will do. There's no doubt about it. Now, Toby, if you ever met him, he is a really good guy. Brought up in Oklahoma. He worked the oil fields in the mid-80s. Guess what? The oil went bust, lost his job, was searching for a job to do, went into entertainment. Of course, he became a great country and Western singer. He's a down-to-earth, real country, good guy. But we really ought to live by his mantra, "Made in America," if you remember that song. We need to fuel our fleet with Made in America fuel. It's America's fleet, America's fuel, made by America's farmers. So that's my close. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, sir. We'd love to open it up for questions from the audience. For our... With the NDAA amendments, but try to summarize this right so that people on the phone can hear. With the these NDAA amendments and other attacks on biofuels purchasing programs by DOD, what does this have to do, if anything, with the increased amount of natural gas that we have available? Is it now harder to sell biofuels because of that increase? Let me sort of start with a comment and ask our panel, much more distinguished than I did, to weigh in. And my comment is, I think you'll hear a consistent message from the defense community on fuels, and that message is mostly about breaking single source dependence. It's a message about choice. It's a message about flexibility. And we heard from everyone up here that the most important thing to have going into a fight is options. And so I think this is a misplaced debate if it's a debate about which future fuels, if viable, clean, safe, we ought to be embracing. I think the answer is let's embrace anything that might work and come up with a combined strategy that uses all of our assets. That's what the military always does to fight, and that's what we do in this case. As we like to say, it is not a silver bullet issue. There's no one technology that's going to solve your problem, whether it's power generation or fuels. It's a silver buckshot issue. You've got to use a range of options to solve the problem. Gentlemen.
I echo Mike's comments about other sources of energy, and we had a little forum yesterday in the Roosevelt Room at the White House, and natural gas was brought up. And I don't know how many vehicles you've ridden in that have been driven by natural gas, but normally it's compressed natural gas. But if you've ever ridden in an environment where there is an IED and you've got a container with compressed natural gas in it, you've got a huge explosion on your hands. And I don't know about you, but I'd feel very uncomfortable riding in a Humvee or any other vehicle driven by compressed natural gas. And I mentioned my artillery battalion with 300 vehicles. Sure, natural gas would be more efficient, and perhaps we can use it, but you've got a real potential problem there. We at ASP are for all kinds of alternative energies. We think natural gas is cleaner and perhaps better than coal, for instance. Obviously, we think it's better than oil. If we can use it to help us get off our dependence of Middle East oil, that's fine, but it's not the sole solution, and we think biofuels are much better.
I'm a strong believer in all of the above solution for energy. I think natural gas is going to be a wonderful commodity to have available to us. But if anybody can tell me what the cost of a therm of natural gas is going to be in 10 years, I'd like to talk to you afterwards and we can invest. The fact is, you have to start investing for the future. You have to make long-term investments. I'm hoping that in 20 years, we'll have hover cars. I was promised one as a child. But along that path, we're going to have to find drop-in substitutes for our fossil fuel before we can electrify or whatever that next thing is. So this is a continuum. And what's currently happening is sort of a case of false equivalency. The question's being asked, well, gosh, you're telling me you don't have enough money for ships, but you're paying $26 a gallon for 450,000 gallons of this biofuel. It doesn't make sense, we're not going to have it. The fact of the matter is, what the Navy is investing in the biofuels is such a small percentage of what the total investment in fuel is. And if you just took the delta in a $10 increase in a barrel of oil, that's $1.3 billion. We could pay for an awful lot of R&D with that. Or the $100 million a month we're paying extra in Afghanistan because the Pakistan gates were closed. So it's not making those false equivalencies and saying that we ought not invest in this because we don't have enough money to do this other thing. Well, this other thing is billions and billions of dollars. Whereas that small investment in biofuels could reap trillions of dollars for the country at large. Tactically, and I did this discussion with my other national security friends, that tactically, biofuels don't make sense right now. They're too expensive, they don't have the same capability, they ought not be doing it. But strategically, if we can start moving towards that drop-in replacement, cost-competitive gallon fuel, it's going to be worth every penny that we invest in now.
Thanks, and to Colonel Nolan's point, I'll just add a quick one about this question of false equivalency, because I think it goes straight to the issue. The two numbers that I keep hearing when it comes to the Navy fuel buy are something like $3.50 a gallon for standard fuel and $26 a gallon for the test fuel. Again, this is not an operational fuel buy by the Navy. The Navy is not buying this stuff to use it in a routine course of business. The Navy is buying it to test it to see if it works, see if they want to buy more, see if they want to scale up, and they anticipate the cost will come down. So it's a very false equivalency that we're asking. It would be like asking in a test phase of GPS, it would be like comparing the cost of a compass to comparing the cost of an experimental GPS unit that they were testing, not buying for the force of testing. These R&D projects are always expensive. At Impact, they're also going to be testing a submarine launch on an aerial vehicle. I'm sure that costs a lot of money too. They want to see if it works. Any more questions? Sir? It's a great question. It's about the long-term cost trends of biofuels. Can they be scaled, and what about the feedstock costs? Anyone on the panel?
We have fire product responses. If it's a drop-in, then I have a choice. Just as the Brazilians right now, when they go to the gas station, if ethanol is more costly than gasoline, they push the ethanol. If the gasoline happens to be cheaper that time, they go with the gasoline. So if we can do the drop-in, it meets our specs, and it's not going to bankrupt the bank, because we as military members we owe it to our taxpayers to make sure we're utilizing every dollar responsibly, then I think we can play through that. And then at the end of the day, I think it's all about the open market. There's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And again, the last thing I would throw out is just as, you know, we didn't wake up one day with a mature oil and gas industry that evolved over time. I think all the clean energy, alternative energy companies are looking for is an even playing field where the incentives that are given to coal and oil, tax breaks, other type of things are made available to them, again, for the open market then to decide who the winners and losers are going to be.
Now, speaking from an industry perspective, the cost of the feedstock's got to be included in the cost of the fuel. There's no question about that. And when I'm looking at a 20-year investment, I'm going to look at what my estimates are on those prices, and I'm going to look at here's the supply, here's the demand. Some portion of our demand can be met with biofuels, some with natural gas, some with other fossil fuels. But it's going to be purely a business decision. And what the Department of Defense has said in their policy on this, that it's got to be cost competitive. Nobody's going to go into business. No industry person is going to go into business and not take into account costs. Because we're actually in this to make money. I know that sounds terrible here, but that's what this is about. So it's going to be the ability of the biofuels to compete in the market. That's what's going to make it happen. But you kind of got to get over that little valley of death. And I don't know if anybody's seen the top four grossing companies in the United States. According to Forbes, three of them are oil companies, and so the day I walk up with my $2.50 a gallon chemically identical drop-in replacement fuel, one of those three is going to say, really, $2.50? Here's $1.50, and I can do this for a long time. The Saudi Arabian budget is based on $40 a barrel of oil. As long as oil is selling at $40 a barrel, Saudis can do everything they want to do. Economically, militarily, information-wise, diplomatically, they can do anything. Anything above that is kind of gravy. So they have the flexibility to move that up and down, because it takes about $2 to get that out of the ground. So again, it's all of those economic factors that are really going to be the decider. And again, as the DOD policy says, it's got to be able to perform, and it's got to be the cost of.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could divert some of the funding that we're using to spend to defend the Persian Gulf and put that into biofuels or other sources of energy? I mean, I'm not advocating reduction in the defense budget, but in the long term, if you could see our way to take funds that we're expending to do to defend oil and translate it over to biofuels, it would help the country and be much better off. So just a small comment.
That's not to say that our military is not going to have global commitments, because we are. We have responsibilities in the world for our friends and allies as well to maintain a stable oil supply. So, but yes, a lot of the conflicts we've been in recently have been evolved around that issue and trying to maintain that stable oil supply. We can. Wouldn't it be good if we could do it in a fashion where we have a stable supply ourselves? When we go into areas that may not be so friendly with access kind of denied or at least challenged, and that we need to be able to ensure we have the supplies. And it's the liquid fuel energy is really what's driving our ships and aircraft out there on the point. As we shift to an Asia-Pacific strategy, even more important, we need to logistically get these resources where they're needed, when they're needed. And if there is any interruption in supply from the Mideast or other places, we need to be able to rely on options. And so it's not to say that we're not going to be using oil for the foreseeable future. We sure are. It's going to be whatever. It's going to be a liquid energy source of some kind that powers our vehicles until we come up with something better. Nuclear energy is great for ships. But it's really not applicable to all cases, and as you know, there's baggage with that as well. But it's worked well in many cases. It saved us a lot of oil in our larger ships, aircraft carriers, and submarines. Although it costs more, and we're looking at the costs of energy, it costs about 40% more to build, own, and operate a nuclear-powered carrier through its life cycle of 50 years than it does if you made it oil-powered. But what has that bought us? It's bought us a tremendous amount of combat power, flexibility, and the ability for that ship to carry much more jet fuel than the conventionally powered ones are. And it's really helped us in our mission. So those are important things to consider. If alternative energy is cost competitive and we have those options, then to have that in our quiver is important as anything else. So. But yeah, global responsibilities are really important for our business.
Thanks, Rick. To add to that really briefly, it's a question, a lot of discussion about how do you incorporate fully the cost of any fuel. You're talking about feedstocks, incorporating the cost of feedstocks. I can't tell you what the unaccounted cost, the externality for security is for a gallon of oil. I can't tell you that. It might be 5 cents, it might be 25 cents, but we know it's there. And maybe that cost includes things like operations in the Persian Gulf and the 15% or so of the defense budget it takes to secure the sea lanes. Maybe that externality includes the fact that 50% of Iran's entire government budget comes from oil, including their nuclear program. So all the work that we are doing to counter and contain Iran for their nuclear program, maybe that's part of those externalities. Maybe the fact that Ambassador Holbrooke, the late Ambassador Holbrooke, felt that the Taliban's number one source of funding was actually oil funding from the Middle East, not opium, maybe that's included in those externalities. Whatever that number is, we know it's real, we know it's there, and it ought to be part of the conversation. Next question. Who's really hoping we actually do secretly have free food?
Beer and wine.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be available afterward, and thanks for coming.